You're listening to a CUNY Radio podcast of BookBeat, presenting readings and discussions with distinguished and emerging authors.
Welcome to BookBeat. I'm Margaret Ramirez. Ruth Ann Robson is a legal scholar and university distinguished professor at the City University of New York Law School. In her new book, Dressing Constitutionally, Hierarchy, Sexuality, and Democracy, From Her Hairstyles to Her Shoes, she takes a fascinating look at how clothes and hair have clashed with the law. The book examines early dress codes in the colonial era and moves on to nudity cases, Muslim headscarves, and more recent battles of transgender teens expressing their identity at the prom. Welcome to our studios.
Thank you.
Now, to start off, I have to say I was amazed to read about so many cases, some of them humorous, some of them shocking, that courts have faced these questions about clothing. And your book starts out with dress codes in the times of kings and queens and Britain's prohibitions placed on the colonists. The BBC called this part of your book the secret history of fashion laws, which I love. So how did these early laws impact the formation of our country?
Well, in very odd and different ways. So I wouldn't go so far as to say that everything was about clothes. But when I was researching this book, I found that many things that I had written and thought about before about colonial history and our Constitution and the forming of our nation really had something to do with clothes or textiles or fabrics or even hairstyles. Interestingly, things around Ben Franklin, things around how Jefferson dressed, how our first president, George Washington, dressed. So all sorts of odd kinds of things, sometimes having to do with the actual formation of the Constitution and sometimes just stories surrounding it.
Interesting. And there is a chapter in the book entitled Dressing Sexily. And it focuses on several issues, but in particular, the one that interested me was the issue of transgender teens and cross-dressing in schools, which has appeared in many news stories recently. Now, what's the problem that the courts face in deciding these cases with these individuals?
I think that so much of clothing really was gendered. And so when you really look back at some of the early, or what I would think of as early cases around teens and boys and having their hair long, there's a lot of interesting, I would call it heterosexism there, in thinking about how will we be able to tell boys and girls apart. And so then kind of fast forward, and we still have that same issue. And one of the ways that people think that they can tell boys and girls apart is by how we dress or how people dress. And when you look at some of these cases, you really realize how gendered our dress is and how there are rules that enforce gender dressing. Big ones are at the prom and as well as how people look in the yearbook. Boys have to dress one way, girls have to dress another way. And when someone wants to not dress in that way, sometimes school officials get very upset and sometimes the people go to court.
You discuss a distinction that has to be made in the courts between rebelliousness and personal identity. Could you speak a little bit about that?
So sometimes, and I think not in the best way, sometimes courts say things like, well, if this really is part of your personal identity and you really feel strongly about this, then the court will protect it. And the court will say, then you should have a chance to embody that or dress that way. But if you just want to do it, and if it's not a part of your central identity, then that's not sufficient. And from my perspective, I think that's really a problem, not exclusively when we're talking about teenagers, but especially when we're talking about teenagers. I think we've all done lots of different things where if someone said, is this really part of your identity? I don't know that we could say yes or no. So right. I think it's a false statement.
Right. And across the country, we've also seen several lawsuits challenging school dress codes with cases involving the Confederate flag or offensive words on T-shirts or how high or low a miniskirt is, or sagging pants. And even in November, there was a case of a 12-year-old African-American girl in Florida who faced expulsion from school because of her big natural hair. And on the face, these seem to be First Amendment issues, but you've written that it's more than that. There are more issues involved. Can you explain?
Yes. So first, one thing is that we have to make sure for the Constitution to apply that it's a public school. Right, so private schools, the Constitution's not going to apply. There might be other rules that would apply, but constitutionally, if it's a public school, the problems have to do with expression, but then also equality. So in the same as we were just talking about before, thinking about, is there some problem with equality of making boys dress one way, girls dress another way? Sometimes you see the equality, people both in private employment as well as in schools and sometimes public employment, say things like, you have to look, quote, natural, right? And so what does that mean? You know, how unnatural is unnatural? And there are cases about natural hair, natural colored hair, all sorts of things like that.
Right. And what about cases involving the Confederate flag or one that you mentioned in your book about wearing a particular T-shirt that expressed sentiments against homosexuals or something like that?
So the Be Happy, Not Gay T-shirts, which were very interesting.
Tell us a little bit about that case.
I think the Confederate flags and the arguably homophobic T-shirts and those kinds of expressions, they run up against, you know, should the school be a safe place for everyone? And I think the answer that most people would say is yes, right? So there's this way in which, when does someone's expression become threatening or quasi-threatening to someone else? See the same thing in terms of gang colors as well. Shirts that promote gun use or protect the Second Amendment, especially after a school shooting. So there are all kinds of ways in which we want our schools to be safe, obviously, but we also want them to be places of free expression, or most people do, maybe not everyone, but I certainly would. And where are those boundaries?
Right. And you expressed in an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times that some schools are kind of going a little, overstepping their boundaries in these school dress codes.
I think that one thing that happens is that school discipline becomes conflated with how people look or how they're dressing. And so that we think that if people are dressed nicely and neatly, then they will behave well. And maybe that's true and maybe that's not. And so there's this conflation about discipline and people looking nice, their pants sagging, things like that. And, or at least what the school officials think is nice. And in doing the research for this book, I've really seen that over time, it's really been the same sorts of disputes. Some people could, and I think this would be fair, think of it as very generational, the older generation trying to police what younger people wear, and younger people then rebelling in order to kind of rebel. I mean, I certainly did that when I was young, and trying to be fashionable.
Right. And another section of your book discusses rape shield laws and dressing provocatively. How effective have these laws been in protecting victims' rights, protecting women's rights?
So I think within the courtroom, they've been fairly effective, although I talk about some cases, yes, you know, that they have been, and other cases not as much. But I think outside of the courtroom and in both in legal kind of culture, you know, what cases a prosecutor would bring, how do we evaluate the credibility of witnesses, those sorts of things. And certainly in wider culture. So we still have protests about, you know, the length of my skirt does not indicate my consent and all things like that. So I think it's really a cultural issue, but certainly a legal issue. And then constitutionally, one of the issues has to be the defendant's rights. Should the defendant be able to put things like this in evidence, as well as do we think that the state should be protecting victims' rights, and here especially women's rights.
Right. And the burden of proof, from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, still lies on the victim. Is that correct?
Well, it would lie on the state, right? So if it were a criminal case, then the state would be bringing the case. And the state has a burden beyond a reasonable doubt, which is to protect defendants' rights.
Right. Could you discuss one of the cases in your book that kind of illustrates that point?
So I think in the book I'm more talking a little bit less about that and more about what the state's duty would be to protect and to create a culture where, you know, a defendant just would not say, and no one would see as credible, oh, yes, I thought this person was consenting because she had on a short skirt or a low-cut blouse. So I think it's more of that conversation.
Right. And with the growth of the Muslim community here in the United States, Muslim women who wear the hijab or the headscarf are facing prohibitions and legal challenges to their dress in the workplace. Why have Muslim women found it so difficult to defend that right in our courts?
I think to some degree they've been finding it easier and easier in the United States as well as in other countries. And in the United States, we have a clear free exercise of religion in the First Amendment. And so that's usually what people assert. The issue has been courtroom, when people have worn more of a face covering, a veil. And one of the more interesting cases, I thought, or at least it was interesting to see how it happened, was in Detroit, a woman had on a veil, and it was a small claims case. And the judge, who was also arguably Muslim, said, I think that that's a cultural practice and not a religious practice. And one of the things that was very interesting to me to think about in the book, it comes up with headscarves and piercings and all sorts of different practices like that, had to do with, so if it's religious and I could say it's religious, then it's protected. And if I say it's just cultural, then it's not protected. And so why do we have that divide? And in some ways, it kind of mirrors what we were talking about before, that if you say that the way I'm dressing is so essential to my identity, then the courts will step in and protect it. But if it's not so essential, then the state and the government should be able to mandate how we dress. And that seems like a hard thing to decide. And it, to some degree, seems like not really the culture that we would want to have.
Along that same issue of Muslim women wearing headscarves, you wrote something very powerful, and I wanted to ask you to comment on that. You wrote that a preoccupation with a woman's rationale for wearing a headscarf should alarm feminists. Could you explain what you meant by that?
To the degree that we're really policing why women are dressing in a certain way and saying, here are ways that are appropriate and here are ways that are not appropriate. And that depends not just on the way it looks, but upon your rationale. And if you have a rationale that we, the state or the government or courts, accept, then we will allow you to dress like that. And so I think that if you could extrapolate from that to thinking about laws that are looking at the reason that women want reproductive services, including abortions, or the reason that people want to get married or don't want to get married, that once you really start saying, well, if you have a good reason, I'm going to let you do that, and if you don't have a good reason, I'm not going to let you do that, I think it's a way of infantilizing women. And it's something that we might say to our daughters if we're parents, or sons.
Interesting. And finally, I know you mentioned you've been traveling and speaking about this book around the world. Could you tell us a little bit about the reaction that people have had to the book and anything that has either surprised you or something new that you've learned that you didn't know before?
Everyone seems to be able to talk about the book in an interesting way, in terms of people have had their own experiences about having their dress or hairstyles policed or their children's dress or hairstyles policed. I've been interested that people have been less interested in the last chapter of the book, which is really about manufacturing clothes and thinking about from slavery and cotton to current conditions about how people are still garment workers and kind of the history of garment work and labor history. And it's interesting that that's not as interesting to people.
Well, thank you very much for coming, Professor Robson.
Thank you so much.
The book, again, is Dressing Constitutionally. It also has an incredible website, which I urge you to check out. It's www.dressingconstitutionally.com.
Thank you.
For more BookBeat, visit CUNY Radio online at cuny.edu/radio. BookBeat is a production of the Office of University Relations.